It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Good morning, Hezzy. It's Laurie, and John is on mute because he's swilling some coffee or something. Anyway,
that's okay.
Good morning, listeners.
Good morning. All the best. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Just fine. It's a lovely, cool, crisp day, cold, crisp day here in Pinehurst, North Carolina. What about New York City?
I think it's about the same. You know, it's not so bad. So, you know, hey, it's winter, so we got to be thankful for when the sun comes out.
No, I know, it's true enough.
Cloudy.
But oddly, I know that you've had some spits of snow up north. We haven't had a single flurry, which if you were born and raised in New York as I was and then lived in New England as I did for decades, you miss it. I mean, you really do miss it.
Yeah.
When you live there, when it hits you, you know, you go, oh, no, and especially as we get older, because, you know, you have years and years of being tired of shoveling snow and slipping on ice.
Right.
But then when you don't have it, I guess this applies to anything in life. When you have it, you know, it's different from when you don't have it. And so we miss the snow down here. We really do.
Well, it's a good feeling, and it's something that we're used to and we're comfortable with, and we miss it. That's part of our demeanor. And there's something special about shoveling snow somehow.
And, you know,
crisis,
I guess
you know, where you
I guess,
yeah, go ahead.
I guess from our standpoint as car reviewers, because we have not had snow or ice at all this winter, and here we're just about to go into February, the problem that maybe we've overlooked with our show is we haven't really talked like we have in the past about safety when you're driving in snow and on ice. And
we can address that a little bit today when we talk about the Blazer.
Well, Johnny,
it's a great
jump
idea.
Right in.
Hi, John.
Hi, Essie. I'm sorry, listeners. I was trying to get a little
morning.
Breakfast in here before the show started.
Honey, go ahead and tell
no
them
problem.
About what a thrilling week we had with the Blazer.
Well, first, I have to tell them, and they've heard this story before. I'm sure a lot of them have, but I owned two K5 Blazers. Those were the old ones and the big ones and the boxy looking ones. But those things would drive up the side of a tree. You put them in four-wheel low. And this was the days back when the big thing was lock-in, lock-out hubs. Now, for those of you that don't remember, it's when you got out of the car and went up and actually physically turned the knob on the front wheels, and that put it into four-wheel drive. And it worked great. But you had to get out in the mud
or snow. Whoa. Stop. No, I had this with my Toyota Land Cruiser where we had to get out of the car and lock the hubs. And it didn't work great. It was very difficult if it was icy and snow. You had to pull over to the side of the road.
Well, that's my point.
And then sometimes they were frozen solid. I mean, it was those manual hubs were a royal pain in the neck. I think one of the greatest innovations in four-wheel drive, and of course now all-wheel drive, is the fact you don't have to do that anymore. My goodness, that was difficult.
Yeah, but when it came out, that was new stuff. I mean, that was big time. If you had one that you could get out and lock in the wheels, you were the deal.
Also, don't you remember the old days, long before all-wheel drive, and when most cars didn't even have an option for four-wheel drive, tire chains?
Oh, sure.
Lest we forget.
Oh, yeah.
I remember my dad putting them on.
Oh, my gosh.
We were driving to drive to Illinois, and we'd hit some of the mountains.
Right, exactly, because inevitably you'd say, oh, it's time to put on the chains when you were on a 45-degree angle on a mountainside slipping backwards.
That's exactly when we did it, of course. The other thing about lock-in, lock-out hubs, not only did you have to get out and lock them in, and then when you got out of whatever you were into and you wanted to unlock them, you had to stop again, back the car up about 10 feet, and then get out and unlock them. You know?
Exactly, because they were stuck solid. They were full of mud and ice. Gosh, we have it good these days, don't we?
Yeah, then the next big thing was there was a push button. You remember you could just push a button on your car?
Yeah, and then the next, and you did that, and then you'd say, am I in four-wheel drive
yet? Yeah, right, because you didn't know. That's true. Yeah, oh, yeah, we've come, there's an old, remember the old Telly Savalas, we've come a long way, baby. You know, that's, it's amazing. It is literally amazing where we have come from in the last 50 years and where we have come from in just the last
five
years. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we take it for granted.
Of course we do.
No,
we're
still
transitioning as well.
Exactly. But we of a more mature age can look back at our past and say these things and reminisce and laugh and sometimes groan. But what about the younger generation that is just coming into car ownership? I mean, this is their norm. What are they going to say in 20 years when they look back at the innovations, just like we're looking back at innovations?
Well, they'll probably say exactly what we're saying. Except they'll have a different starting point.
Yeah,
but I think
it's
important to get a historical perspective.
They'll be saying
things like, oh, my car won't hover more than about 25 feet off the ground.
Say, exactly that.
I don't know what's wrong with it.
Do you remember when you had to drive a car yourself instead of have the car drive itself?
Oh, that was the old days. Oh, my gosh. How did we get along with those cars we had to drive, for Pete's sake?
And in the future, some astute person is going to look back on this radio show and pull this audio clip and say, see, they had such vision of the future. Anyway, talk about what a wonderful week we had with them. we're going to be famous in 30 years when we're dead. Yeah. Talk about the Blazer, honey. What a great week.
Thank
what
you,
a great week we
so
had.
Real. Lori, that was very real. I like that.
Yeah, I know.
It's very scary. Talk about the Blazer, sweetie.
When we had the old Blazers, and I loved it, absolutely loved them. And, of course, then they went to a smaller version, and then they went away. And that was during all of that transition when people were trying to figure out, oh, my gosh, what kind of cars do people really want to buy? And the Suburban became very popular, if you'll remember. That was the first huge, big vehicle. And all the housewives wanted them, you know, because they could put groceries and kids and stuff.
Suburban owned that market.
They did.
Period, end of story.
Yeah, they certainly did. So it's taken a long time. The Blazer actually came out last year. And if you'll remember, we had a 2019 Blazer. In fact, we went over to Clark Chevrolet Cadillac, the local dealer here.
In Pinehurst.
Yeah, when we didn't have a vehicle, we were without a vehicle, and asked them, called over and talked to the gentleman who owns Clark, one of the Clarks, and asked him if we could get a vehicle to drive for a little while. And he said, sure, come over. And that's what they gave us was the Blazer.
We knocked our socks off.
Oh, my gosh. And that's the one that had the mirror, the rearview mirror, and you turn the switch, and it became a camera that's actually giving you a live feed of
like
what's behind your car.
Panavision.
Yeah, it was like, I can't drive with this thing on. This is way too weird. Anyway, so we got a 2021. Not a whole lot of difference in the styling, which I loved anyway. It's much sleeker. It's wide. Really hugs the road. The first thing that I noticed about it was how smooth it rode. One of the best riding vehicles I have been in lately.
And to that point, I didn't notice anything about it, and I'm saying that because that car fit like a glove.
Yeah, yeah.
In every respect. Mm. You didn't have to think or feel or react or anything. You just, you were
very intuitive. This was an intuitive car. This was one of those where you got in and you sort of knew what to do. You didn't have to figure out anything. You sort of just knew what it was that you were supposed to do. Let me give you a little background to it. When we got it, we didn't get a Maroni, and the Maronis are the ones that you would be like the sticker in the window in the back, in the usually the back side window.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a Maroni, and it says, you know, this is what it is. This is the base. This is what's all. Well, we didn't get one of those. Normally, they have one in when they send it to us. So I looked it up. Well, if you type in 2020 Chevy Blazer, you can get to the Chevrolet website, and it brings up a whole thing about the Blazer. And it talks about different models, but all it says on our car, all it said on our car was, and if you look at the back, which is where you usually get the designations, it said Blazer AWD, which is all-wheel drive. Okay. Then it has Blazer on the side door. So I didn't have a lot to work with. So I went to Blazer AWD. Well, I couldn't really find out anything except all-wheel drive. So I couldn't really – so I looked at the books in the glove compartment, and it talked about different engines, if you had, you know, these different engines that are in these cars, but it didn't identify which one was in that car. So thanks to Lori's education a long time ago, I copied down the VIN number, the vehicle identification number, and got on the Internet and brought up the vehicle by its identification number. And it said...
The exact vehicle, of course. Every VIN number is different for each car.
Right. It's 18 digits or something. So, but I brought up the VIN, typed in the VIN number, and it brought it up, and it said it was an RS. Okay. So now that helped. So then I go and look up the Chevy Blazer RS, and I find out that there are, that the RS, there's one above it, I think it's called the Supreme, but I find out that the RS can have two different engines in it, that the standard engine is a V6, which, you know, I applaud, because I think cars that are this size need a V6, but anyway, or it could have a four-cylinder, 2.0-liter, four-cylinder turbo. And in driving the vehicle, Lori and I decided that that's what we had. You could feel when you...
The transmission shift.
Yeah, you could feel the transmission shift, and you could feel the turbo kick in. If you've ever driven turbos, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one...
It's that vroom, vroom factor.
Well, but it's not identified as an RS. It has a, we believe it has the 2.0-liter turbo, which was interesting. And then you look at the things that are included on an RS model, and it shows that there you can have heated seats and a heated steering wheel. Well, ours was interesting. It had heated seats, but it doesn't have a heated steering wheel.
Nor did it have, at least we couldn't find it, nor did it have air-conditioned seats.
Right. Only heated seat. But it also, what was I going to tell you? It also had, or didn't have, I'm trying to think. Oh, I just lost my train of thought. It had leather seats. It did not have cloth seats. Mm-hmm. It had leather seats throughout, which is, a sort of an upgrade kind of a thing. Here's the big deal, and then we'll talk a lot more about the car, but here's the big deal. So you look at these things, you look at the car, you look at the attributes that are on the car, and you think, well, what does the car cost? Do you know that the Blazer starts at $28,800? I can't even imagine, first of all.
That's the starting MSRP. This is incredible for a car this size, this well-appointed. And
absolutely.
Johnny,
and ours
which is
an RS and had all these other things on it, it was a staggering $33,000.
And it was totally, there's nothing you could want. I mean, unless you really need air-conditioned seats. Or
you wanted
a sunroof.
That was it. You could add some things. But my gosh, we drove this car a lot over the week. Lori and I both drove it. And it was just, I don't know what else you'd want in a vehicle. I really, as far as carrying, we carried friends of ours. Celebrating her, 89th birthday. We put people in the back seat. They had plenty of room. They had
easy five passengers, tons of storage. Put that second seat down and you could
double.
Oh my goodness.
You actually doubled the storage space. It was like 30, you had 30 cubic feet in the back with the seats up. When you put the seats down, it was like 64 cubic feet of storage.
Unbelievable.
And comfortable. And all the electronic things to control your seat, for example. And, of course, the steering wheel goes in and out and up and down. The panel.
Telescopic.
The panel in front. The
easy to read.
Easy to read. Talk about the touchscreen, because that was, I was trying to drive and you were generally doing those kinds
of things. Yeah, the touchscreen is a little different. I mean, each touchscreen seems to have its own personality depending on the maker and the model. But this touchscreen was, I mean, it was easy to program. The only complaint I have about the car is that in order to change the temperature of the vehicle, which had dual control temperatures for the front passenger and driver,
mm-hmm.
was to go onto the touchscreen by hitting one of four buttons, radio,
climate control,
home, and there was
navigation.
Mm-hmm. And you have to touch one of those buttons directly under the screen, and then that brings up the screen, and then you adjust the temperature of the car that way,
uh-huh.
even though the panel allowed you to change the intensity of the fan and whether the fan would blow on the feet or up in your face or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that you could do just by touching the panel. But in order to access the temperature control, you had to actually go into climate and then access it from the screen, which made it
mm-hmm.
like a two-step process instead of a one.
Right.
That I did have a problem with because it wasn't as simultaneous as I would have liked.
I think the thinking mm-hmm. along those lines, now that we've sort of had the car and been through it sort of thing, on this same row of switches, which are underneath the radio, if people are listening and they're interested, look at the article that I wrote because I actually put pictures in there to show the location
yeah,
of
fantastic.
These things because I thought it was really well done. That Chevy had
yeah.
done a good job of displaying all this. But in that row of switches, the first switch on each side, on the passenger side and on the driver's side, is actually your seat heater. So you can turn on, you can set the temperature, for example, at 70 or 68 or 72, whatever you want to set it at. If you're cold when you get in and you sit down, the first thing you do is you can hit the seat heater. And, of course, it has three settings, high, medium, and low and off. But you can hit the seat heater, and I think they did that thinking that you would want instantly to warm up, and then as you got warmer, turn the seat heater down to off, and then the car would be at the right temperature. That's my thinking. But I'm like Lori, if you can control the fan speeds and you control where you're putting the heat at your feet, at you or on the steering, or on the windshield, and you can do any combination of those, why wouldn't you put the temperature control there? So there is actually a place that gives you what the temperature is set at, but you can't.
You know what, John? It's probably the 2021 version. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Johnny, I want to tell about our Doomsday moment, but before I do, tell the Doomsday story, and then I'll announce our Doomsday moment. Go ahead.
Oh, a friend of mine, Lori Wall, who is a teacher, or I think she's retired now, but she was a teacher, an English teacher, and she was talking about something in class one day, and they have vocabulary and all those kinds of things. And one of the kids, I think it was a girl, instead of little Johnny, we'll make it a girl, but the girl raises her hand and asks a question, and Lori Wall explained the answer. And the girl says, "Oh, I'm such a doonsay." And Lori said, "What?" She said, "I'm such a doonsay. I just don't know anything." And Lori Wall said,
"Do you mean a dunce? Is that what
you said? Do you mean a dunce?"
Is
that what the word is? So yeah. So now go ahead.
So big drum roll. This is our doomsday moment.
Okay.
Johnny said, check the glove compartment and see if there's a Maroni
there. Oh yeah.
Well, I looked. I couldn't find how to open it.
Pushed on the top,
pushed on the bottom, tried to pull it open. But, I mean, it was, and we couldn't find it. And Jaya said, "I don't know how to open this thing." Well, that whole day we went without figuring it out. And the next day, Johnny said, "I figured it out. There was a little button to the left on the panel that said glove compartment.
Glove box.
So you press it, and then the glove pops."
And the glove box opens.
So that
was
our doomsday moment.
Well, duh, that was our doomsday moment,
yeah. The other thing that there
is. You know what I got to ask you? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The other thing is what? Well, my question, thank you. My question is really, is there something intuitive that is cultural? In other words, because I always hear you say different things about different vehicles, different manufacturers, and maybe that's part of that the cultural difference, you know, from a Japanese car to a German car to an Italian car to an American car, Korean car, and so on. Is it because we have an American sensibility that the cars are more intuitive to our thinking? Have you thought of that?
Are they more intuitive to our experience, you say?
Yeah, to our experience. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what we're used to. Well, I agree with that. I certainly agree with that.
Well, the first example that would come to my mind is, and it's increasingly less so, but the vast difference in driving an American make versus a Mercedes.
Yeah.
Well, that's been going on for years.
That's a whole other
Mercedes I got in, I couldn't figure out how to roll down the windows because the window buttons were in the console in the middle of the car, not on the window side. It took me forever to figure that out.
So I guess the answer to your question, Hezzy, is it wasn't a cultural thing as much as an intelligence thing. The Germans were smarter.
Oh.
That
could be the thing.
The only way that I can
see that. I should
get in
touch with my German side, right?
Yeah, your German side. The only way I can answer your question is it would not be in the mechanics of the car so much as the size of the car and the car's capability. Mm. So, for example, we see in Great Britain, we see in Continental Europe, a much smaller car is the average, although that, too, is changing as far as the average family car. Their station wagons are half the size of our station wagons. They are a compact car or have been until very recently, a compact car mindset. Let me finish. Do you think that you could drive a Suburban in the streets of Rome? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
So that's a cultural thing. I think the size of a car. I also think the design of a car. We always talk about European design. Well, the Europeans have a beautiful flair, far more than Americans, which were, frankly, much more boxy and usable. They were functional. So I think that you see that cultural difference based on these factors. And interestingly enough, going back to an average family car in the UK. They don't have all these bells and whistles, by and large. They don't have these safety features that we talk about, or the cameras, or they're very basic cars. They're nothing. They're nowhere near as advanced as what we have in the United States here, which we are taking for granted.
I want to say a couple of things.
All right, dear.
One is, first of all, the European design models, everything about what you're talking about. One, a lot of it is fuel driven. First of all. Secondly, it is a continent, I suppose, that has more people much closer together. You don't find lots of big open spaces. Most of the people are centered in big cities. And so you have a lot of people in small areas and living on top of one another. Compact apartments. Nancy's place, Nancy Hogarth. Friend in Edinburgh, I think, is a perfect example of like where she lives, which is how a lot of people live. The biggest thing that I have found from Europeans and from South Americans who have come to the United States for the first time was they couldn't get over how much room there was, how much space between houses, even in a community. Everything was spread out, how wide the roads were, all of those kinds of things. And a lot of what our vehicles were designed and became was a reflection of our society, much like what the European cars became, a reflection of their society. Mm. Why do you think the VW, the Bug, was so popular? But here, because we lived in a big country, oil was not a problem. We had oil, we had oil supplies, we were the consumers of all that. We could build big cars with big engines, and we didn't worry about gas mileage, and we had lots of distances to cover, and we wanted to get there in a hurry, and some of those kinds of things. And I think all of that kind of thing influences car design. I think the aerodynamics that you see on a lot of cars that are designed in Europe support this about fuel economy and, less drag. And I think that Americans like that design and really purchase cars based on what they like the looks of them, the fact they got good gas mileage, blah, blah, blah. I think that certainly influenced American automotive designers to be more like the European cars. And if all that's true...
Because we're...
No, go ahead.
If all that's true... Well, because we're getting to the end of our time frame, I want to ask you, I was so impressed by the write-up, but even more impressed, and not to depreciate it in any way, but I was more impressed by the price point.
And I agree.
That with the product itself, when you balance it out, is just phenomenal, through the roof. I don't even understand where that came from, because we used to shy away from that. Price was no object. But this time, I think Chevrolet has done a unbelievable, home run on this one, because the price is right. The car is everything that you can imagine or want.
Yes.
And it's really very, very conducive, I think, for a lot of people who want this type of size car. The look is good, and it's got all the accoutrements. Phenomenal.
It's actually a little bit bigger than my Ford Edge, lengthwise,
uh-huh.
widthwise, and heightwise. So it's a little bit bigger,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a huge vehicle, but it's certainly a big enough, comfortable vehicle. You could easily put a family in it. And I'm with you.
Yeah.
I can't get over it. It has five driving modes, two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, which is all-wheel drive, sport mode, off-road, something else. But I can't get over that they could have this much on this vehicle, doing all of these things for $36,000.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, you would get in a vehicle like this and expect it to be $50,000 at least.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
we were, and then when I looked, and the starting price is $28,000. Now it may not have much, not enough engine power. I don't know, but.
Johnny,
yes?
I need you to rein in your enthusiasm. We're
what?
Coming to the end of our time, and I have something to say.
Okay.
This vehicle
right.
was the first vehicle, the first American-made vehicle that we ever felt would come face-to-face with a high-end price-wise and what you get for your buck. This is the first American car that we have driven that we really felt was in keen competition with cars like the high-end models that was the biggest bang for your buck. Okay, this said... because we're running out of time. Next week's car is the 2020 AMG Mercedes GLC 63S Coupe. Now, let me tell you something.
It's a four-door, by the way.
It looks like a small, very racy SUV. I am standing in front of it. It is perhaps one of the most beautiful cars I have ever seen, bar none.
Oof.
And next week, Johnny and I are going to tell you, dear listeners, why it's worth every cent of $96,425. But I'll tell you.
Yeah, but wait a minute. So it's got. It's probably going to have heated and seats, and they probably give you a massage too, right?
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
This is the only car of its type that I've ever seen with a running board. And they're gorgeous. They're pierced aluminum. This car is a work of art.
Stop! You're giving away everything.
And inside, it's we're going to have to go to college to figure out how to drive this thing. But I just wanted to tell our listeners that they have something. They have
got
a real treat for next week's show. Yeah, exactly.
Got a week to get your degree.
That's about it. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say.
Side.
Yeah.
Get in touch with your German side and your mother's love for Mercedes.
That's what I'll have to do. But in any event, so
I actually have a German side.
So Johnny, now you've
so
got 90 seconds to wrap up our show for this week.
Well, you've taken me away from the Blazer. Why did you do that?
Because you were going on and on, honey. You know you do that sometimes.
It's a good vehicle. It's a wonderful car. I like talking about it. What do you want me to do?
Well, I just wanted to make sure I was able to tell everybody about next week's fabulous.
I have an idea.
Yes.
I have an idea. Oh, next week when you talk about the AMG, you could bring up the Blazer.
Okay. Yeah. Talk about how they were like and different. I can do that. I can do that.
Okay.
Well, anyway, we opened the show saying that it was a cold, crisp, beautiful day in Pinehurst. I'm going to reiterate and close the show because I'm standing out here with just a T-shirt on and it's freezing. So I'm going to go back in the house and out from the unheated garage where this gorgeous Mercedes is stored at the present.
Beautiful.
And it's a V8 engine.
Yeah.
A bi-turbo.
All right.
Automatic V8. Oh, John is going to love this one. All right, Hezzy, that's us for this week.
Okay,
last
so I got
thing,
two
Eddie,
words for you.
Last...
Gute Reise. Have a good trip.
Dankeschön.
And Ezzy,
all right,
I still want to
well,
close
guys.
With. I want to close with something about the Blazer. If you're looking for a vehicle like this, you got to look at it. You got to look
got
at
to.
It. You have to look at it.
Biggest American bang for your buck in an American-made
yeah.
car.
Yep, agreed. All right,
beautiful.
Buddy, we'll let you go.
I love
thank
it.
You
care,
so much.
Thank
bye.
You. Thank you.
Bye.
All the best. Bye. Oh, how exciting. I can't believe it. It is such a great product. You've got to read the review. And it's naturally, it's posted on the Yonkers Tribune website. And it is so compelling to have this particular car being produced. And the price point and the accoutrements to it just makes it a must-buy if you're looking for a car of this size and capacity. Just really brilliant. Okay, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on with the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat.
Check.
Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. We're going to try to cover some international news, which I think you'll find very compelling. She's finally free. Asia Bibi breaks her silence after the Pakistani death row hell that she had to endure. So, recounting the hellish conditions of 8 years spent on death row on blasphemy charges, but also the pain of exile, Pakistani Christian Asia Bibi has broken her silence to give her first personal insight into an ordeal that caused international outrage. Now, Bibi was sentenced to death on blasphemy charges by a Pakistani court back in 2010. But then dramatically acquitted in 2018. She now lives in Canada at an undisclosed location. French journalist Anne-Isabelle Tollet, who has co-written a book about her, was once based in the country where she led a support campaign for her. She's the only reporter to have met Bibi during her stay in Canada. In the book Enfin Libre, which means finally free, published in French on Wednesday with an English version due in September, Bibi recounts her arrest, the conditions of prison, the relief of her release, but also the difficulty of adjusting to a new life. Quote, "You already know my story through the media," end quote, she said in the book. "But," she says, "you are far from understanding my daily life in prison or my new life," she said. And she continues to say, "I became a prisoner of fanaticism," she said. In prison, quote, "fears were the only companions in the cell," end quote. She described the horrendous conditions in squalid jails in Pakistan where she was kept chained and jeered at by other detainees. "My wrists are burning me. It is hard to breathe. My neck is encased in an iron collar that the guard can tighten with a huge nut," she wrote. "A long chain drags along on the filthy ground. This connects my neck to the handcuffed hand who pulls me like a dog on a lead." Quote, "Deep within me, a dull fear takes me towards the depths of darkness, a lacerating fear that will never leave me," she said. Many other prisoners showed her no pity. Quote, "I'm startled by the cry of a woman. To death," the other women join in hanged exhortation. And blasphemy is an incendiary charge in Muslim-majority Pakistan, where even the whiff of an unsubstantiated allegation of insulting Islam can spark death at the hands of mobs. her acquittal on the charges, which stemmed from an accident, or rather an incident in 2009, when she argued with a Muslim co-laborer, resulted in violent protests that paralyzed the country, led by firebrand cleric Hanim Hussein Rizvi. Now, Bibi, who vehemently denied the charges against her, argued in the book that the Christian minority in overwhelmingly Muslim Pakistan still faces persecution. Quote, even with my freedom, the climate for Christians does not seem to have changed, and Christians can expect all kinds of reprisals, she said. Quote, they live with a sword of Damocles over their head, end quote. And while Canada gives her a safer and more certain future, Bibi has to come to terms with likely never setting foot in her homeland again. Quote, in this unknown country, meaning Canada, I am ready for a new departure, perhaps for a new life, but at what price, she says. My heart broke when I had to leave without saying goodbye to my father or other members of the family. Quote, Pakistan is my country. I love my country, but I am in exile forever, she said. And just an unbelievable story, and look how long it took for things to change. Now, bear with me a moment because I want to go back to our studio screen for a second. Everything's fine there. And I wanted to go over to the fact of what's happened on the world stage. And this is with regard to Brexit. So two different political cultures have come about. One is a divided Scotland that has braced for none other than Brexit itself. It seems that despite a majority of Scottish voters rejecting Brexit in the 2016 referendum, Scotland leaves the European Union along with the rest of the United Kingdom on January 31, tomorrow. For some Scots, this shows that their nation is being ignored and bolsters the case for leaving the United Kingdom. On the other side of the independence debate, some rue that Brexit makes it more difficult to make the case for unionism, while others argue that Scottish grievances over Brexit are unjustified. Edinburgh is a city of two souls. The ancient old town climbs up to Edinburgh Castle, towering over the Scottish capital atop an extinct volcano. And this thousand-year-old fortress is the most besieged place in Great Britain, largely thanks to attacks from English soldiers, most frequently during the bitter wars of Scottish independence in the Middle Ages. The new town incarnates the British side to Edinburgh character. Its construction started in the 18th century to provide grand new housing for the city's flourishing bourgeoisie, the middle class, which thrived on the back of Scotland's union with England in 1707. Its exquisite buildings shaped the distinctive Scottish stone into quintessentially English architecture. At the boundary between the old and new towns in Princes Street Gardens, the Scott Monument, in all its austere grandeur, represents a synthesis of their identities. It memorializes Sir Walter Scott, the 19th century novelist, whose tales mourn the loss of Scotland's time-hallowed clan society, while celebrating the emergence of a modern nation and political union with England. Yet some in Edinburgh argued that Brexit shows this union is no longer working. As Scotland prepares to leave the European Union on Friday, against the will of 62% of its voters in the 2016 referendum, it doesn't matter what the people of Scotland decided. Evidently, Brexit made me more pro-independence, said Catherine, a young Scottish nationalist, walking past the Scott Monument. Quote, it's always felt like we're kind of second to the English viewpoint, maybe because there are less of us. It feels like they don't take our opinion seriously. I think it's a backward step coming from a sort of English nationalism, another Edinburgh local who declined to give her name said of Brexit. The notion that Scotland has been ignored over exit is a, quote, fairly accurate judgment, end quote, added Alan Massey, who is one of Scotland's most acclaimed contemporary novelists and a staunch unionist, as well as a Remainer. Brexit has been carried out on, quote, the assumption that there was this narrow majority in the United Kingdom. Therefore, we must go ahead, and it doesn't matter what the people of Scotland have decided. They're part of the United Kingdom, and they've got to come with us, said Massey, who lived in Selkirk near the border with England in one of the most unionist parts of Scotland. In this context, the Scottish National Party, which combines secessionism with Europhilia, performed well in the 2019 general elections amid a small uptick in support for Scottish independence. It won 48 out of Scotland's 59 seats with 45% of the vote. We've seen a modest, not dramatic, increase in support for independence coming from people who voted Remain in the 2016 referendum, observed Nicola McEwen, a professor of politics at Edinburgh University. The day after those Brexit-focused elections last December, Sturgeon asked for a second independence referendum, saying that the SNP, the Scottish National Party, landslide was a, quote, strong endorsement, end quote, of, quote, not having to accept life as a nation outside the European Union. Johnson's government rejected this request earlier this month. Now, for one prominent supporter of Scottish independence in the 2014 referendum, which the unionist side won with 55% of the vote, Brexit is one of several factors showing that Scotland and England now have, quote, two different political cultures, end quote. Sir Tom Devine, widely regarded as a preeminent living historian of Scotland, said that the two nations' divergent attitudes to Europe over recent years can be attributed to Scots' outward-looking nature as a nation of immigrants going back centuries. Scotland has never suffered over the past 20 or 30 years the kind of inward-looking form of nationalism that England has, he said. Starting from around the 12th and 13th centuries up until the census of 2001, Scotland has experienced sometimes really in vast numbers net emigration, Devine continued. Because of that, you could argue that Scots have always had to look outside. One Scot living in England offered a similar explanation for a divide between the two nations over Brexit, arguing that it is a product of Scotland's greater ease with its own sense of national character, a, quote, perception of a lack of national identity or a threat to the national identity and culture, end quote, was a key factor behind Brexit, argued Tawheed Ali, a scientist from the village of Dalmellington in western Scotland, who has lived in southern England for over two decades and who opposed both Brexit and Scottish independence. I think this is less of an issue for Scots, he continued. Obviously, my name is not Scottish, but my father immigrated to Scotland in the early 1960s, and I feel very Scottish. I am Scottish and then British, whereas I think that in England, they've always struggled with the question of what it means to be English. Now, others argue that the difference between the two nations are exaggerated and that any Scottish sense of injustice over Brexit would not justify leaving the United Kingdom. I don't think Scotland was ignored over Brexit. I think there's a Scottish persecution complex, and it raises its head now and then. And it's always been there, especially from the English, said Charles Simpson, a Scottish artist living in Selkirkshire, who is in favor of Brexit. I understand the grievance that Scotland feels, voting mostly Remain, but I don't think that's cause for them to break away from the Union, said a Londoner living in Edinburgh as a student at the city's university. I think at this point, any more divisiveness is not beneficial to anyone. Well, quote, thinking that Scottish nationalism is bound up with Brexit would be wrong, said David Spouforth, a former head teacher at an Edinburgh school, now also living in Selkirkshire, who voted Remain in the 2016 Brexit referendum. The Scottish National Party was founded in the 1930s, and it has always been a nationalist party, and now Brexit has given them an excuse. Now, Brexit certainly hasn't driven away Scottish unionism, the British aspect of the national character embodied by Edinburgh's new town. Most polls continue to suggest that Scots would reject independence in a second referendum. And one survey in early December by researchers YouGov and the Times of London, even pointed to a 10-point lead for the Unionist side. However, Brexit makes life a lot harder for Scottish Unionists, especially those who voted Remain, Massey argued. In a nation where the Brexiteer Tories are the only strong opposition to the Scottish National Party, quote, if you want to say no to Brexit and no to Scottish independence, what are you actually saying yes to? Very, very compelling, you know, I think a description of what's going on there. And that becomes really quite important. Now, one second. This is interesting about a European court. They fault France for prison overcrowding. So that's going to definitely be an issue that will probably come up into the future. And now let me just quickly see here. This is fascinating. An appeals court in France has cleared the French Cardinal Barberin of shielding pedophile priests. It seems a French appeals court has acquitted a French cardinal of covering up the sexual abuse of minors in his flock. The appeals court in the southeastern French city of Lyon gave no explanation on Thursday for its ruling. And Cardinal Philippe Barberin, Archbishop of Lyon, had been convicted in March and given a six-month suspended sentence for failing to report a predator priest to police. But Pope Francis refused to accept the cardinal's decision to resign until the appeals process is complete. Now, the prosecutor's office had sought the acquittal accorded by the court. Quote, this decision is logical, end quote, one of Barberin's lawyers, Felix Luciani, said outside the courtroom. He said the cardinal had faced down public rumor and calumny. Barberin, who is 69, said at his appeals trial in November that he filed an appeal because, quote, I cannot see clearly what I am guilty of, end quote. Now, the verdict comes at a time of increasing scrutiny around the world of the Catholic Church's role in hiding abuse by its clergy. The court had ruled that Barberin, in wanting to avoid scandal caused by the facts of multiple sexual abuses committed by a priest, preferred to take the risk of preventing the discovery of many victims of sexual abuse by the justice system and to prohibit the expression of their pain. Bernard Prenat, the now defrocked priest at the center of the scandal, described to a court at his trial earlier this month how he systematically abused boys over two decades as a French scout chaplain. And Prenat said his superiors knew about his, quote, abnormal, end quote, behavior as far back as the 1970s. Had the church sidelined me earlier, he said, I would have stopped earlier, Prenat had said. Prenat, who's now 74, faces up to 10 years in prison in what is France's biggest clergy sex abuse trial to date. He's suspected of abusing around 75 boys, but his testimony suggests the overall number could be much higher. That verdict is expected in March. Now, the case against Barberin hinges on a 2014 discussion with victim Alexandra Herzez, who told the cardinal about the sexual abuse he had suffered in the 1980s by Prenat during scout camps. Herzez felt the priest should no longer lead a parish. Barberin told the appeal hearings that that he followed Vatican instructions after that discussion with Herzez. He suggested he could not have done more. At the trial of Prenat, victims testified about how much power the priest had held over them and the lifelong damage that his abuse caused. Quote, I saw this community that admired this man, and I was his protege, his pet, said victim François Diveau. Very, 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 very just unbelievable. So this thing is not going away. Pedophilia and the church is evidently rampant, which is not a good thing. Now, let me just look at some other things here. Okay, bear with me one second. Yes, this is what I was looking for. The coronavirus death toll has risen to now 170 as nations accelerate a China evacuation. It seems that hundreds of foreign evacuees from the Chinese city of Wuhan entered quarantine on Thursday as deaths from a fast-spreading virus rose to 170 and markets shuttered at the impact of an inevitable big hit to the world's number two economy. All eyes were on the World Health Organization, which has held off declaring the flu-like coronavirus a global emergency, but was to reconsider that later in the day. Such a declaration would trigger tighter containment and information sharing guidelines, but may disappoint Beijing, which had expressed confidence in defeating the devil virus. It could also potentially spook markets further. The fear is that they, meaning the World Health Organization, might raise the alarm bells, so people are taking money off the table, said Chris Weston, head of research at Melbourne brokerage Pepperstone. The day after the state economist forecast the crisis would lop a percentage point off China's first quarter growth, global stocks tumbled. The yuan, the Chinese currency, hit its lowest this year. Oil prices slid again, and safe haven assets like gold gained. The coronavirus, which originated in an illegal wildlife market in the central city of Wuhan, has now claimed 170 lives and infected 7,711 people in China. That's what the latest official data show. Almost all the deaths have been in Hubei province, of which Wuhan is the capital, where 60 million people are now living under virtual lockdown, staying inside their homes and only venturing out with masks on. Canteens are not open. Most of the shops are closed. We cannot go out and buy food, Si Tu Tun, one of 60 students from Myanmar trapped in Wuhan, told online news outlets the Democratic Voice of Burma. Honestly, you have one big potato and three packs of instant noodles and some rice, he said. Myanmar plans a special flight to get the students out within 3 days. As other countries fly citizens out, cut flights and corporate travel and heightened screening, another 105 cases have emerged in at least 16 places from Japan to the United States. An Italian cruise ship, 6,000 passengers were kept on board while tests were held on two Chinese travelers suspected of having the coronavirus. Chinese New Year celebrations scheduled for Sunday in Paris have been canceled. The crisis has stoked a wave of anti-China sentiment around the globe, from shops barring Chinese tourists to online mockery and surprise checks on foreign workers. Now, Australia, South Korea, Singapore, New Zealand, and Indonesia were quarantining evacuees for at least 2 weeks, though the United States and Japan planned shorter voluntary isolation. Three Japanese from 206 evacuated on Wednesday were infected, and worryingly, two of them had not shown symptoms, Tokyo said. A second Japanese flight included 9 people showing fever or coughing symptoms, broadcaster NHK had said. India was the latest nation to report a case, a student of Wuhan University, and South Koreans protested at facilities earmarked as quarantine centers, throwing eggs at a minister. The weapons that will protect us from the new coronavirus are not fear and aversion, but trust and cooperation, said South Korean President Moon Jae-in, as Seoul prepared to evacuate the first of about 700 citizens from Wuhan. In the corporate world, Alphabet Inc.'s Google and Sweden's IKEA were the latest big names to close China operations. Samsung Electronics said it had extended holiday closure for some Chinese production facilities. Airlines to suspend flights to China include British Airways, Lufthansa, Air Canada, and American Airlines. Air France cabin crew unions were demanding the same. Sources said that the company has already allowed pilots and crew to opt out of China flights. Fueling concern over the damage to productivity, thousands of Chinese factory workers on Lunar New Year holidays may struggle to get back to work next week due to extensive travel restrictions imposed to stop the spread of the virus. Global policymakers are anxious, with China taking center stage at U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's news conference on Wednesday. China's economy is very important in the global economy now, and when China's economy slows down, we do feel that, not as much, though, as countries that are near China or that trade more actively with China, like some of the Western European countries, he said. Streets in many Chinese cities were largely deserted and tourist attractions shut. Starbucks coffee shops were requiring temperature checks and masks. Cases of human-to-human transmission outside China are a particular concern to medics, but it is too early to determine how lethal the coronavirus is, as there are likely to be many cases of milder infections going undetected. It has an incubation period of between 1 and 14 days. And Chinese National Health Commission Minister Ma Shiwei said that this week the virus was infectious during incubation, unlike severe acute respiratory syndrome, another virus that emerged from China and killed about 800 people in 2002 and 2003. The global cost from SARS was estimated at $33 billion, or 0.1% of the world gross domestic product in 2003. And many economists fear the impact on global growth could be bigger this time than from SARS, as China now accounts for a larger share of the world economy. Okay, let's go back to our studio screen and let's play for you what's going on at the Yonkers Tribune, and we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
And if you want to reach out to Yonkers Tribune, they have a new number which you can avail yourself of. It's their cell number, it's their office number, it's their text number, it's their voicemail number. And that number is 347-415-4326. So that number is 347-415-4326. That's the office, the cell, the text, and the voicemail number. So you can reach them if you'd like. Okay, let's see what else is happening. And this time it seems the White House is trying to block incriminating a book by former National Security Advisor Bolton. The White House yesterday objected to the publication of a book by President Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton, which depicts Trump as playing a central role in a pressure campaign on Ukraine, while members of the United States Senate asked a spree of questions in the impeachment trial. A letter from the White House National Security Council to Bolton's attorney said the manuscript, based on a preliminary review, appeared to contain, quote, significant amounts of classified information. I guess the operative word is appeared. Well, some material was deemed top secret and could, quote, cause exceptionally grave harm to the national security, end quote, according to the letter dated January 23 to Bolton's lawyer. The letter surfaced with the Senate in the midst of a pitched battle over whether to remove Trump from office, in part due to conduct described by Bolton in the manuscript. Contradicting Trump's version of the events, Bolton wrote in the unpublished book manuscript that the president told him he wanted to freeze $391 million in security aid to Ukraine, until Kyiv pursued investigations into Democrats, including Biden and the former vice president's son, Hunter Biden, the New York Times reported. Now, under federal law and the non-disclosure agreements your client assigned as a condition for gaining access to unclassified information, the manuscript may not be published or otherwise disclosed without the deletion of this classified information, the letter had said. The manuscript was submitted to the White House for pre-publication review, a process that civil libertarians have said gives the government too much power to censor speech. Democrats view Bolton as a figure who could help them solidify their case against the president. Reports about the book's content appears to boost their argument in the trial. And Democrats want to call Bolton a Republican foreign policy hawk and a small number of other officials to testify. Trump's fellow Republicans in the Senate have resisted the idea of having any witnesses. The letter said that the White House would be in touch with Bolton's lawyer with detailed guidance for manuscript revisions. And senators began the first of two planned days of posing questions to both Trump's legal team and the Democratic lawmakers in the House of Representatives who have served as prosecutors in the trial on charges of abusing power and obstructing Congress arising from his request that Ukraine investigate political rival Joe Biden. Democratic senators used their questions to try to undermine the defense presented by Trump's legal team and make their case for witnesses, including Bolton. Republicans used their questions to try to bolster the contention of Trump's team that he did not commit an impeachable offense, even if Bolton's assertions are true. The Senate is expected to acquit Trump, but allowing witnesses such as Bolton could inflict political damage on him as he seeks re-election on November 3rd, and Biden is a leading candidate for the Democratic nomination to challenge Trump. Bolton's allegations go to the heart of the impeachment charges. Democrats have said that Trump abused his power by using the security aid passed by Congress to help Ukraine battle Russia-backed separatists as leverage to get a foreign power to smear a political rival. And Trump's legal team has argued that the evidence supporting that allegation is based on hearsay. A Bolton spokeswoman had no comment on the White House letter. Neither his publisher nor lawyer immediately responded to requests for a comment. Well, the Senate is expected on Friday to vote on whether to call witnesses. Democrats need four Republicans to join them to get a majority in the 100-seat Senate. Republican leaders are hoping to vote as quickly as possible to acquit Trump, leaving him in office. Removing Trump from office would take two-thirds majority. There are 53 Republican senators, and none has publicly advocated removal. The Democratic-led House impeached Trump last month. Now, Trump lashed out at Bolton on Twitter. He said Bolton, quote, couldn't get approved for the ambassador to the United Nations years ago, couldn't get approved for anything since, quote, begged, end quote, me for a non-Senate-approved job, and added that if I listened to him, we would be in World War VI by now. Now, Trump added that Bolton, who left his White House post in September, goes out and immediately writes a nasty and untrue book, All Classified National Security. Who would do this? Now, Trump, who has denied Bolton's account, has said he fired Bolton. Bolton, a foreign policy hawk who served as a temporary recess appointee, quote unquote, as American ambassador to the United Nations under Republican former President George W. Bush, has said he quit. Well, responding to a question by top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer, lead House prosecutor Adam Schiff said there would be no way to have a fair trial without witnesses. Quote, and when you have a witness as plainly relevant as John Bolton, who goes to the heart of the most serious and most egregious of the president's misconduct, who has volunteered to come and testify, to turn him away, to look the other way, I think is deeply at odds with being an impartial juror, Schiff had said.
Democratic questions prompted answers from House prosecutors that Trump did not need to have committed a statutory crime to be convicted. Republicans asked Trump's lawyers questions aimed at convincing senators that the House impeachment process was illegitimate from the start. And senators submitted questions in writing to be read aloud by U.S. Chief Justice John Roberts, who is presiding over the trial. Okay, well, let's just quickly look and see what else we need to cover. And one second. And again, this is happening on the world stage. We move over to Madrid, to Spain. Madrid is delaying separatist talks over the Catalan snap election. Spain's central government on Thursday, today, said the announcement of snap elections in Catalonia would delay planned talks between Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez and the region's separatist leadership. News that the regional election would be brought forward was announced by regional president Quim Torra on Wednesday, but he did not give a date, suggesting sometime after mid-March. The date was brought forward following a major dispute between Catalonia's two ruling separatist parties, Together for Catalonia and the Republican Left of Catalonia. Now, the announcement came ahead of a key February 6th meeting in Barcelona between Torra and Spain's socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to lay the ground for talks on resolving the separatist conflict. In response, Sanchez's office said that the meeting would go ahead, but that the negotiations would not begin until a new regional government was in place. The government is hoping to be able to begin the dialogue after the Catalan people have spoken. As soon as the elections are over and there is a new regional government, then we will begin talking, said a statement. The government remains willing to start the process of dialogue with the Catalan institutions to resolve the political conflict. Now, the talks have been agreed as part of a deal with ERC in exchange for its support in getting Sanchez through a key investiture vote earlier this month. But the delay was swiftly denounced by the ERC as a flagrant breach of the agreement, which was completely irresponsible, its party spokesman Sergi Sabria had said. Sanchez, who himself is in a fragile position at the head of a minority coalition government, still needs ERC support to pass Spain's own much-delayed national budget. In a radio interview on Thursday, Torres said he would bring up the right to self-determination and amnesty for the 9 jailed Catalan separatist leaders when he meets Sanchez, both of which have already been rejected out of hand by the socialist leader. So we'll have to see where all that leads. Then we move to South America. Evidently, two are dead as a new wave of Chile protests break out. A young man has died after being hit by a hijacked bus in Santiago, the second fatality in renewed unrest in the Chilean capital, police said on Thursday. That's today. Trans-Santiago bus that hit the 22-year-old who died in hospital early on Thursday had been stolen moments earlier by masked assailants, the Carabineros National Police said in a statement. The man had been protesting at a barricade at the south of the capital. Protesters at the scene severely beat the man who was behind the wheel, inflicting serious injuries, and set fire to the bus, police had said. More than 3 months of protests in Chile have left at least 30 people dead, at times bringing the South American country to a standstill. On Tuesday, a fan of Santiago-based football team Colo-Colo died after he was hit by a police van during clashes between supporters and security forces following a local match. Colo-Colo fans held a protest on Wednesday over their death, burning barricades in the streets around their team's stadium and also torching the local metro station, a police station, and a shop. The protest was led by the Garra Blanca group, one of a number of fan groups known as Barra Bravas, that are akin to Europe's football hooligans. They also have joined in protest against President Sebastián Piñera, while ordinary fans have also sung songs at matches against the ruling party and its leader. In the south of Santiago, a local government office was torched and at least three supermarkets looted in the latest flare-up. Two police stations elsewhere in Santiago were attacked, while violence also broke out in the towns of Valparaiso in the center and Concepcion in the south. Unrest broke out on October 18, initially against a modest hike in metro fares in Santiago. It quickly mushroomed into wider protests against social inequality, and Piñera has launched a raft of measures to try to quell the unrest, including a raise in the minimum wage and state pensions and health reforms. He will also hold a referendum in April on charging the dictatorship era constitution, or changing rather, the constitution. But while the frequency and intensity of protests have subsided since October, they have continued regularly nonetheless. So, something very, very compelling to say the least. Now, bear with me a moment. Just want to make sure we've caught up with the news. 1 second. Okay, and we move over to Israel. Israel is shoring up the West Bank and Gaza troops, because protests have turned violent after Trump's peace plan has been announced. The Israeli army announced an increased presence in the West Bank and near Gaza on Wednesday evening as U.S. President Donald Trump's controversial peace plan sparked outrage among Palestinians. The plan, seen as overwhelmingly supportive of Israeli goals and drafted with no Palestinian input, gives the Jewish state a U.S. green light to annex key parts of the occupied West Bank. Was widely cheered in Israel, but sparked fury among Palestinians, with protests breaking out in the West Bank and the Hamas-run Gaza Strip. One rocket was fired from the Strip Wednesday evening. In response, the army said that Israeli fighter jets and aircraft struck a number of Hamas terror targets in the southern Gaza Strip. Palestinian demonstrators and Israeli security forces clashed in various locations in the West Bank, and further Palestinian protests are expected in the coming days. Now, the Israeli army announced on Wednesday it would deploy additional troops in the West Bank and near the Gaza Strip. Following the ongoing situation assessment, it has been decided to reinforce the Judea and Samaria and Gaza divisions with additional combat troops, the army said in a statement, using the Israeli term for the West Bank. Trump, who unveiled the peace plan on Tuesday at the White House alongside Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with no Palestinian representative present, said his initiative could succeed where others had failed. But the plan grants Israel much of what has sought in decades of international diplomacy, namely control over Jerusalem as its undivided capital, rather than a city to share with the Palestinians. It also offers U.S. approval for Israel to annex the strategically crucial Jordan Valley, which accounts for around 30% of the West Bank, as well as other Jewish settlements in the territory. The terms have been roundly rejected by Palestinian leader President Mahmoud Abbas, vowing the proposal would end up in the dustbin of history. Abbas is expected to visit the United Nations in the next 2 weeks to address the Security Council and explain his rejection of the plan, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations said on Wednesday. Hamas said it could never accept anything short of Jerusalem as capital of a future Palestinian state. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged the Palestinians to come up with a counteroffer. I know the Israelis would be prepared to sit down and negotiate on the basis of the vision that the president laid out, Pompeo said, as he headed to Britain on a five-nation tour. In the West Bank city of Bethlehem, demonstrators threw rocks at Israeli border guards, who responded with rounds of tear gas. Three protesters were hospitalized after being hit by Israeli firing clashes near Ramallah, in the central West Bank, the Palestinian Health Ministry had said. In Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, protesters set tires alight, while others hoisted banners vowing they were united against the deal of the century in a jibe against President Trump's proposals. Trump's plan foresees the creation of a contiguous Palestinian state, but under strict conditions, including a requirement that it be demilitarized. Now, the Palestinians would only be allowed to declare a capital in outer parts of East Jerusalem beyond an Israeli security wall. And those terms were warmly received by some in Israel. Historically, history knocked on our door last night and gave us a unique opportunity to apply Israeli law on all of the settlements in Judea and Samaria, said Israel's right-wing defense minister, Naftali Bennett. Now, the Blue and White Party, led by Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's main election rival in the March 2 polls, or election polls, embraced Trump's proposals as being, quote, a strong, viable basis for advancing a peace accord with the Palestinians. But the head of Israel's left-wing coalition, Labor Geshel Meretz, Amir Peretz, condemned Netanyahu's expected move towards unilateral annexations, quote unquote. Meanwhile, on the streets of Tel Aviv, some residents voiced concern that Trump had paid no attention to what the Palestinians actually want. Sounds like an excessive implementation of Israel's ambitions with harsh, aggressive ignorance of Palestinian ambition, said a Tel Aviv resident by the name of Uri. Well, major powers and some regional players responded with caution, saying Israel's project deserves study, Trump's project deserves study, while stressing that a durable solution to the conflict can only emerge through Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. French Foreign Ministry welcomed Trump's efforts and pledged to carefully study his proposal. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, however, slammed Trump's plan as, quote, completely unacceptable, end quote. The ambassadors from three Arab nations, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, were at the White House providing some evidence of Trump's claim to have growing support around the region. Saudi Arabia said it appreciates Trump's efforts and called for direct Israeli-Palestinian talks. Russia, a growing force in Middle East politics, sounded skeptical. We, quote, we do not know if the American proposal is mutually acceptable or not, Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov told Russian news agencies. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Now, let's just go through. There's just more to look at, so bear with me a moment. One second. I'm a little bit longer, really. Wanted to check what else is around. All right, one second. All right, I need to look here. I want to check to see if anything has transpired in Europe or if we've caught up. And one second, move into the Asia market. Okay. All right, and then one last effort here. Just want to make sure that we've got everything covered. Okay. All right, this is quite interesting because we'll just have to see how things go from a business perspective. These are some concerns and some issues. Evidently, Boeing reported their first annual loss since 1997. So the 737 MAX crisis had led Boeing to report its first annual loss since 1997. The aviation giant insisted we'll get back on its feet and back in the skies, but it faces a long haul. So that's going to be a major issue. We'll see where that lands them, if at all. So we'll see. And this is a report from Frans van Katte that you might find interesting. It seems that Brexit is happening for real this time. January 31 kicks off an 11-month transition period. And it's a special program where Frans van Katte looks at the UK's exit from the European Union, how it impacts business from the tech industry to fishing and the bankruptcy and the banking sector. So bear with me a moment as we lock into this. One second. Okay, we'll be able to get started in a moment. Okay.
Welcome to People and Profit. This week, all things business and Brexit. I'm Kate Moody. Coming up, Brexit effects on tech. How will startups and digital firms adapt to the newly reshaped European Union? British fishermen are heading into uncharted waters as their industry becomes a Brexit battleground. And we take a look at equivalence, a concept that could be key to the future of Britain's banking and financial services. It's been over 3.5 years since British voters decided to leave the European Union. Industries across Europe and around the globe have been trying to prepare for Brexit and the 11-month transition period that follows. Discussions on trade, regulations, and security can all begin after the 31st of January. The head of the International Monetary Fund told France 24 that while the clock is ticking, both sides should strive for a thorough and comprehensive agreement.
It has to be a good agreement that is helping businesses to flourish on both sides. Whether it takes longer or less time is not so important. What is important is the quality of the agreement that would be reached, because the UK and the European Union are quite integrated. Let's hope that the agreement would bridge the two sides.
Well, to get an idea of what's in store for tech companies across Europe, we can speak to Gianpiero Lotito, co-founder and CEO of Facility Live, the highest valued startup in Italy. Thank you for being with us. Tell us, what do you think Brexit is going to change, if anything, for Europe's tech industry?
Brexit can represent an opportunity for tech companies to establish a better relationship with the UK, with the UK market, of course. For UK, is a way to be more attractive for tech companies. So if in the next future, the rules between Europe and UK will be good to have a better relationship, probably it will represent an opportunity for both.
Is the UK still an attractive place for tech companies to put down roots?
In this moment, yes, because the rules didn't change anymore. We can see after the Brexit, and we can see what will happen in negotiations between EU and UK, and what the UK will do to be more attractive for tech companies.
We've seen UK-based startups raising a record-breaking amount of money in the last year, despite the uncertainty over Brexit. Do you think that that strong funding trend will continue, even as attracting talent perhaps become harder?
Of course, it depends from the rules of exchange of workers and many other conditions that can influence a difference in relationship between European companies and the UK market, the UK financial market. I think that the next year and the next couple of years will tell more to us about how this can become, as I told before, an opportunity or to be a problem in the next future relationship. We will discover it.
What have other European cities been doing to attract business away from the United Kingdom?
Personally, I believe that the opportunity for Europe in the next 5 to 10 years is to establish a network of small valleys, cities that can create the ecosystem condition to be attractive for innovation. And I am not sure that we will have big cities that will become the best attractor in Europe.
Do you think that Brexit will have any impact on the EU's development of its digital single market?
Of course, because digital single market is in part new rules, because if you have a fragmented regulation between 28 or 27 after the Brexit countries, this is very difficult to be competitive. Digital single market is a first giant step to have a tech industry in Europe credible and with a global dimension in competition. But there is also another challenge, another objective. If you have a strong digital industry in your area, you can support better also the other industries. Because as the Silicon Valley lesson and the Asian lesson teach to us, the digital industry can be a booster for the other industry because the primary innovation is on the ground and not imported from other geographical blocks.
In your opinion, what's the biggest challenge facing Europe's tech industry at the moment?
The biggest challenge is to have in 2, 3, 5 years the first group of tech champions that can compete at European level, at a global level. If we will have this group of tech champions on a dimension that will be higher than the current, we will have the traction for the whole ecosystem to be faster in growth. But I think that what the European Commission is doing now will boost this process, giving the possibility to accelerate the rising of a strong European tech industry, because I think that the world needs a strong European digital industry to be balanced.
Giampiero Lotito, thanks so much for joining us on People and Profit. Well, the choppy waters that separate the UK from mainland Europe will be in focus as post-Brexit talks begin. British fishermen are hoping that foreign boats will be restricted from fishing in their waters, but they could find themselves swimming against the tide.
Dawn is still hours away when Davy and his crew set off from North Shields in northeast England. The lights of other fishing boats glint on the horizon, but there are far fewer than when Britain joined the EU in 1973. Davy blames Europe's fish-sharing quotas. Boats from the continent now take 6 times more from UK seas than British boats do from European waters. As they land the first catch of the day, Davy says he hopes that after Brexit, Britain can net a bigger share.
Our own fleet surely has to come first. When we leave Europe, we've got to be looking at a bigger picture to get a better, sustainable fishing for our own country. Never mind these former lads.
Fishing crews like Davy's account for less than 0.1% of the UK's economy. But for an island nation like Britain, they're a symbol of independence. Brexiteers even staged a fishing flotilla on the Thames ahead of the 2016 referendum on EU membership. Since then, though, a lot of the promises that negotiations would be easy have proven overconfident. And Davy worries politicians may be promising a pot of gold that isn't there.
the trouble is, once again, we've been promised and promised, and at the last minute, they'll sell you down the river because they've got no spine, any of them.
Back in port, last night's catch is being sold to a handful of buyers. Most of these fish are exported to Europe, making some wholesalers worry that any trade dispute with the EU could be damaging.
On a local level here in North Shields, probably 60% of that would go to the European markets predominantly. So without access into those markets, it would really hit the industry hard.
The EU's trade chief has already suggested fish are up for grabs, saying fishing rights could be the price of British access to European financial markets. In a choice between this tiny industry and the vast city of London, Britain's politicians may sacrifice the economic minnow in a bid to steer the wider economy away from the rocks.
Well, the financial services sector made up around 7% of the British economy in 2018. Brian Quinn's been looking at how the industry can do business with the EU post-Brexit.
Well, Kate, the UK is aiming for access to a system called financial equivalence. It's a regulatory framework under which non-EU firms are granted access to the bloc's markets if their home rules are considered close enough to Europe's own. Some 30 countries have provisions in place, including the US, Australia, and Japan. That means their investment firms and clearinghouses can work with EU clients and trade on EU stock markets without the costly process of setting up an EU subsidiary. Equivalence, however, is not equality. It doesn't cover retail or commercial banking, nor a large part of the insurance market, all of which the UK had free access to as an EU member state. It's also politically volatile. Brexit backers worry that the system could leave the UK as a rule taker, having to abide by EU regulations without having any say in them. And equivalence can be unilaterally withdrawn by the EU on just 30 days' notice, as happened to the Swiss Stock Exchange last July. All that is part of why many UK banks have pushed ahead with EU subsidiaries, and that could cost London business and jobs. At over 30 billion euros a year, the EU is the UK's biggest financial services export market. More than 300 UK firms have already opened EU subsidiaries, with around 7,000 jobs estimated to leave London in order to staff them. And while it remains to be seen what Brexit will bring, it has already hit the UK's image. A recent survey of senior finance executives saw London lose its spot as the world's top financial center for the first time to New York.
Brian, thanks so much for that update. Well, that's all for now, but don't forget you can follow France 24's Brexit coverage on our website and Facebook page. You can also listen back to this show as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher, and you can tweet me at Kate A. Moody. Until next time, thanks for watching.
Okay, let's just look at some other things. And this was very interesting. Well, we're not going to cover the UK car output, but evidently it's sunk quite a bit since the Brexit thing has been going on forward. I'm going to look at something else for you in a moment. And this is revealing. It seems that Westchester County Democratic Party has endorsed as Democrat Democratic Westchester District Attorney Anthony A. Scarpino Jr. for re-election. So he was endorsed yesterday night at a county party convention Wednesday. Democratic delegates from towns and cities across Westchester selected the incumbent district attorney as the designated Democratic Party candidate in the primary election that will take place on Tuesday, June 23rd. And in his 3 years in office, DA Scarpino has overseen across the board reductions in crime, a broad reduction in crime, and in Westchester with an array of initiatives. Murder was down 33%, robberies down 57%, aggravated assault down 19%, rape down 24%, larceny down 30%, burglaries down 57%, motor vehicle theft down 31%, and total violent crime was down 20%. So, you know, the Westchester County Democratic Committee is led by Chairman Reggie Lafayette. There were other people that came to speak highly of Mr. Scarpino, the Westchester County Clerk, Tim Idoni, New York State Senator Shelley Mayer, another New York State Senator, Peter Harkham, and a New York State Assembly member, Amy Paulin. And the people of the different committees that were involved that made the decision is North Castle Democratic Committee, Mount Kisco Democratic Committee, Rye Town Democratic Committee, Somers Democratic Committee, White Plains Democratic Committee, Yonkers Democratic Committee, and Yorktown Democratic Committee. And that's it. So it's going to be very interesting to see, even though he has the designation of the Democratic Party, it is sure that we're going to have other people who contested and were hoping to get the designation of the Democratic Party, they will likely still continue their effort and will challenge him during the primary. And we'll see what ends up coming from there. And so you never know, he could either win or he could lose, and we'll see where that goes. And let's quickly look at some other things as well. One second. You may find interesting on the Yonkers Tribune, there's a letter to the editor regarding New York 17 candidate. So this is for the congressional race to represent New York 17, which is presently have Nita Lowey at the helm, but she has advised she will not run for re-election. So the outlook is very, very big. I think there's one Republican, and I think there may be a total of 11 people or 9 people altogether that are vying to get the Democrat support. So it's going to be very compelling to see where all this goes, and we'll see how it works. One thing that is interesting, though, when you have so many people for the June 23rd, actual convention that will decide the primary. What's interesting is when you have someone who is an incumbent facing so many other people vying for the same position, and if their names are not well known, as would a 3-year office holder such as Anthony Scarpino, so you got people like like Rocha, who is running, like Mondrian, Rocha is running for seven. No, you know, I'm confusing it. So I think the only one that's running against him, against Scarpino is Rocha. So we'll have to see where that goes. And I think those might be the only two. So there will be an interesting thing, because the decision makers will be the voters rather than the party. So the different parties. So it's going to be very interesting to see where all that leads. And that's going to be, it's going to be very interesting. Tomorrow is Friday. And tomorrow we're going to speak to Gabriella Metzl. What's interesting about her is that she wrote an article, which we just posted, she permitted us to post on the Yonkers Tribune, and the title of it is Abortion, Conscience versus Party Politics. So it's going to be very interesting to discuss that. We're going to discuss that with her tomorrow. And let me just quickly look. I think she's on, before I tell you, let me just make sure of the right time. Yeah, she's going to be on at... 1 minute here. 1 second. Okay, yeah, she's going to be on at 10:30. We're going to begin the show with Victoria Garrity, the mayor of Ossining. Then we'll speak to Gabriella Metzl, who's the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Unvarnished blog. And then we're going to speak to Dennis Richmond and part of the Educational Foundation. So we'll have a lot to talk about for sure tomorrow. And the last half hour, I'll try to catch up with you with respect to what's happening on internationally and domestically as well. I want to quickly go back to our studio screen, actually to our website at the Yonkers Tribune. Bear with me a second. 1 minute here. Okay, just want to see what else we have. It's been so many news stories are coming out. It's like literally overwhelming. I could barely keep up with it. Let me just see. Oh, yeah, I should remind you of this because, tomorrow's Friday, and the Yonkers Police Department and McDonald's have decided to get together, and there's going to be a McDonald's host coffee with a cop. So McDonald's is going to host a coffee with a cop gathering tomorrow, Friday, January 31st, from 9 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock in the morning. And at the McDonald's restaurants at 155 South Broadway, and you'll be able to talk with a cop, meet a cop, ask some questions, and so on and so forth, and discuss issues, learn more about each other, and so on and so forth. So that's definitely big to do, and a lot of people will appreciate that opportunity, that's for sure. And 1 second here. 1 minute. Don't know what. Oh, I see what happened here. I need to make a correction here. Bear with me a second. All right. 1 minute. All right. Evidently, this is going to be interesting. Change something here. Now, I tell you, quite often I'm just like flabbergasted at what happens on the internet when I'm writing. I'm really a very good speller, very unusual that I don't know how to spell a word. So when I put something in, what's interesting is sometimes the spell checker, even though I use it as a background, the spell checker makes its own decisions. And even though I can't contemplate it, that there'd be a problem, sometimes there is. And I don't always catch it for whatever reason because it doesn't come up. And to tell me that, okay, this is the problem. And, because it doesn't highlight it in the word processor. And so that becomes very, very disturbing and very unnerving, to say the least. So that's what's going on. Anyway, it looks to me as though that's the end of our time with you today. I hope you enjoyed the schedule, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow. Be well. And let me get back to our studio screen and wish you a goodbye.